Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey Nat, did you know that the FDA doesn't require tampon companies to disclose a list of the ingredients in their tampons?
That's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, so major brands use synthetic ingredients and harsh chemical cleansing agents, whereas Lola is 100% cotton and BPA free.
And for those of you who are a little more environmentally conscious and don't even want to use the applicator, they make applicator lists, they make various sizes, and panty liners for those who want them. And yeah, you can customize your subscription so you can get exactly what you need, you know, in the right sizes.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it gets delivered directly to your door, so you don't have to worry about
like... Lazy girl's dream.
Exactly. You don't have to worry about running off to the store because they will be there every month at your door. Also, $5 off your first box.
Come on, guys. Can't beat that.
Pretty exciting. Head on over to trymylola.com/babes. That's B-A-B-E-S. And start your subscription today.
Go, guys. Do it.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history, babe.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
And I'm Nat, and we are the Art History Babes.
Yeah, there's only two of us today. Ooh. We're continuing on with our thesis series.
That we are.
Yeah, going to talk about some research. Anything exciting going on in your life right now, Miss Natalie?
I wish I had more to report. Not anything super exciting. I am going to Hawaii in 2 days, so I'm excited for that. Yeah, but...
That's going to be dope. You'll have to report back on that.
I will. And last time I was over there, I ended up actually in some pretty cool galleries, so maybe I will have some art-related stuff to report back to you guys.
Oh, you should do some, like, blog postage on some art shit in
that
Hawaii.
That would be cool. Yeah, I'm going with my dad and my sister, and they are also art lovers, so I will coax them into doing that.
There you go.
Cool.
Yeah, my life's been pretty boring recently. Oh, I went and saw Dunkirk last week with...
Remind me what that's about, because I totally know the name, but it's nondescript, so it's not real.
I will remind you what it's about. So, I'm not a war movie person. I don't dig war movies, really, but I do love Christopher Nolan. So I was like, I'm going to see this. And I had heard like really interesting things about it. And still not a war movie lover. However, it was really cool. It was really interesting and like a very different portrayal of like a war story. Like there was no big like romantic story arc. There really wasn't a lot in the way of human relationships and in the sense that there wasn't like a lot of dialogue. There was very little dialogue.
Okay.
But it was like really well done. And it was also like crazy because so Dunkirk is the story not of a battle, but it's actually the story of a retreat in World War II.
Hmm.
So it was a British retreating from the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a very different approach to the war movie. Like usually you're talking about some kind of battle that was like a big battle that was won or some
kind of... You know that the side that you want to win is going to win.
Exactly.
Even if it gets crazy in the middle.
So there was no... It was actually the movie starts at the beginning of the retreat. It starts with the British trying to get, they're in France and they're trying to get back across the water, back home.
Yep.
And the Germans just keep bombing them and like, yeah, it's crazy. But it's
Germans.
Like...
Just kidding. My boyfriend's German. I'm not.
I'm somewhat German. I'm a chunk German.
I might have some.
But I mean, Nazis. I think we can.
Yeah,
I think we can scoff at all the Nazis.
Fuck Nazis.
All day long. But yeah. So it was the story of this retreat, and it was done in very Christopher Nolan style. It's very like. A lot of like heavy music, like there's like moments where it feels like you're watching Batman, like very like boom, like
love some Batman.
And it was just, it was cool. It was a cool, I think, approach to a war movie. So as someone who doesn't like war movies, I still gotta give props to this film. So if you're into that kind of stuff, you definitely have to check it out. If you're any kind of like a Christopher Nolan fan, you definitely have to check it out. And I also just think it was a completely original take on the war movie. I think it's probably in the future going to represent an interesting shift in the quote-unquote war movie.
Yeah, no, I want to see this now.
Yeah,
because I will say, it's not like I'm super into war movies for the fact that they are war movies, but some of the best movies that I could name that I've seen are war movies. Does that make sense? Like, I never seek them out, but some of the best movies I've ever seen happen to do with it. I think it's just such a dynamic topic. You know, like,
oh, definitely.
It's fucking crazy. Like, that's something about human nature that will never get boring. Like, why the fuck do we feel the need to always be at war? Like,
and honestly, I think that's part of why I don't like war movies, because I sit there in the theater and I just get, like, mad. Like, why do we do this? And then, like, I can't focus anymore. But it is also part of what makes it so interesting.
Right.
But you should see it, because I'd like to talk to you about it.
Sounds good.
I think you'd really like it. It's definitely...
Oh, I will for sure.
It's definitely good. It's definitely going to win some awards. I know it is. But
that's
really been about it. I've been working on podcast stuff and trying to find a job.
Yeah, I've been doing that too.
Been about it. But yeah, so thesis. Hey.
So you guys are going to hear some really cool stuff about Corey, semi-related to Corey's thesis.
Yeah. So, this episode is going to be related to my thesis research. It's going to be very theory heavy. So we're talking like big ideas more so than talking about actual like specific artists or artworks.
But don't be scared away by that at all, because it is super interesting and you'll be able to follow it. So if theory freaks you out, stick around, because it's a good theory level for introductory people as well as you hardcore theorists out there.
Also, theory is just really fun and crazy and interesting. So like, if you like big ideas and big questions, you'll probably like this. And I'm going to try and... Like, Nat's going to keep me in check if I start throwing around big theoretical words.
I'm on it, guys.
So we'll make sure it's, like, broken down in a way everyone can understand, whether you're familiar with this material or not. So, my thesis research was about... It was about a whole lot of things, but it focused a lot on the huge question of craft versus art, which is just, like, such a big question in art and art history, and... Many people have many different ideas about, like, what defines something as art, what defines something as craft, what's a difference, is there a difference? So that was a very central, like, jumping off point for me, because it's a question that I've been thinking about since undergrad. Like, it's just a very important question to me. Like, who gets to decide that this thing is art and this thing is the typically considered lesser craft? That's not my stance on it, as you will soon find out, but that is how the hierarchy tends to work, is that you've got like fine art and then the crafts are somehow below fine art a lot of the time. Luckily, I think we're definitely moving past that, but that's still a question that like kind of ruminates and like people think about a lot. So that was kind of the jumping off point of my thesis research. And then I took that and started to research just the history of quote-unquote craft, and I got really into the political element of it, because if you're a listener of the show, probably it doesn't surprise you that I got, like, super political with my thesis. So, like, I got really interested in how throughout time, people have politicized craft production for a lot of different reasons, which is really interesting. And there's also been a history of the marginalization of certain groups of people and that lining up with their production of craft. So, i.e. the marginalization of women and the fact that things like embroidery and knitwork are typically considered quote-unquote women's work. So this idea that, like, a lot of times in the hierarchy of art theory, craft somehow falls to being a lesser art. And interestingly, throughout time, the people who are most commonly performing that craft or lesser art are marginalized groups. So you've got some interesting intersections there. So I got really into this research, and I basically picked a lot of times in history where this has been a part of a very important, maybe like example of craft production. And I brought up all the way forward with a main focus on contemporary craft activism, also known as craftivism. I'm not going to talk too much about that today because I think we're going to save that for a later episode, because craftivism is a very contemporary and powerful thing. And I'd also like to do an episode where we all maybe get to pick things about craftivism and talk about them.
It's so big.
It is. It's so big.
I learned that from Corey. It's a huge, it's a huge realm.
It is. It's a
she
big
knows
thing.
Knows a lot about this, guys.
It includes a lot of things: radical embroidery, yarn bombing. Most commonly, if you're very unfamiliar with what craftivism is, the Pussy Hat Project that happened for the Women's March. That was an example of craftivism. But there's, like, so much of it, and it spans a lot of different groups and a lot of different ideas. So we'll definitely do a future episode on it because I think it's very relevant. And it's just, like, an interesting art form that I think we could have a lot of different conversations about. So a lot of what I'm talking about here today is theory that I applied to things like craft activism and the DIY movement and William Morris and the arts and crafts movement, who I will talk about a little bit today. While this episode I'm focusing on the theory, hopefully it will do future episodes more specifically about these movements that maybe engaged with that theory a little bit. So that's my really long disclaimer, I guess. But yeah, so essentially what I'm talking about today is this idea of craft and a morality, like a very specific kind of morality that's associated with craft and has been associated with craft production throughout a lot of history that a lot of people don't really know about. Like, it's not something that's at the forefront of things, but it's definitely there in a lot of these craft-based movements. So kind of taking it way back, we're going to start back in the Middle Ages. So, Middle Ages, there was really no separation between art and craft, right? Mm-hmm. Like, an artisan was a craftsman. Mm-hmm. So, whether you painted pictures, or you made books, or you made pottery, like...
What were they called? The, guilds.
Yes, craft guilds.
Yeah.
So, in the Middle Ages, we didn't have this idea of, like, the artist versus the craftsman. They were all the same thing. They were all someone who made stuff.
They were skilled in some way, and they used that skill to make things.
Exactly. Which I think is a great definition. Like, that's an artist. That's, like, some, like, you made a thing.
Put me in Merriam-Webster.
Yeah.
I butchered that. I was not right.
It was Merriam-Webster. Yeah, it's... Basically, that was the idea. Like, you made stuff, you were an artisan, you were a craftsman, whatever. Then the Renaissance happened, and we had this rise of the artistic genius, which is a concept I have a lot of issues with, which we should also do an episode just on the artistic genius. We could say so many things about it.
That would be a good one.
We have so many future episodes. Yeah. So the Renaissance happened, and we had the rise of the artistic genius. Obviously, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, like your household names.
Your Ninja Turtles.
Your Ninja Turtles. And also what happened in the Renaissance was a disconnection between fine art and craft at this point, because you have the genius. The genius is the artist, the one who's doing, who's painting the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And then you have your craftsmen who are still doing stuff that needs to be done, i.e. making pottery or making chairs or what have you. But there is a disconnect that's happening, because for some reason that person making that chair is not on the same level as someone painting a chapel, right? So we start to have this disconnect between the two ideas. Jumping forward a little bit, and this is really where my research really gets going, is with the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution happens a few centuries later, and this is really where the beginnings of this idea that there is a certain morality, or morality like a goodness, an inherent goodness to craft production, starts to happen. So, Industrial Revolution, often associated with, like, the rise of capitalism, even though that's very, like, capitalism can be traced back to the Middle Ages, like, to be fair. But, like, a lot of times, capitalism and the Industrial Revolution, like, they definitely worked together. Mm-hmm. And the Industrial Revolution, very, very rough years here, because something as crazy as the Industrial Revolution can't really be, like, specified very well. But a lot of times it's considered roughly 1760 to, like, 1830. So that's a good span of years. That's, what, 40 years, where all of a sudden mechanized production is the thing. Just machines fucking everywhere. Like, everything's about machines and what machines can do, and factories and, like, production via machines, right? And in so many ways, the Industrial Revolution, it changed our lives. It changed the way we lived our lives, and it did a lot of good things, you know?
We're happy for, you know, flushing toilets and such.
Yeah, right.
Know, septic tanks.
Printing press. Yeah. It's all great.
We like books. Like, we haven't figured that out yet. We like books.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, Industrial Revolution definitely did a lot of good things, but it also just changed life in crazy ways. I like to compare what we're going through, and a lot of scholars like to compare what we're going through with, like, the technological revolution to the Industrial Revolution. It was just a huge shift in the way that humans lived their lives, right? Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Obviously, during this time, humanity's approach to crafting goods greatly transformed, because we're relying on machines to do the work for us. We have just this mass production going on, and it really created the shift. Like, a lot more people are working in factories on part of, like, an assembly line, as opposed to in their homes or their own studios making things, because you have machines that are making them for you, or at least helping you make them.
Yeah.
This resulted ultimately, and I would say this idea probably happened 1840s, 1850s, when there started to be this backlash against the Industrial Revolution, and that didn't stop the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution kept going, but, like, around the 1840s, 1850s, we start to have this backlash, because what some people consider to be a, like, cold and personal industrial aesthetic emerged, especially in Great Britain, where it was, like, the hub of the Industrial Revolution. So you have both architecture and just goods, like goods that would have previously been handcrafted are now being made by machines, and they all look the same. And sometimes, you know, they're not super decorative. They're kind of, you know, cold or impersonal, or, like, it created what some people believe to be an aesthetic that was lesser, I guess you would say, than what came previous to the Industrial Revolution. So, like, lesser than what came from the medieval craft guilds, and lesser than what came from the Renaissance. Like, you have, and I mean, I guess, lesser in a very aesthetic way.
Yeah, and wasn't it, I mean, correct me or steer me in the right direction if I'm off, but the idea of one person creating something start to finish versus the assembly line, approach,
yeah,
where one person does one part of something, so no one ever finishes anything. And, like, if you start thinking about that theoretically, it does get interesting. You're like, oh, yeah, you never really make anything. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not necessarily bad, but you have to stop and kind of think about it for a second. The idea of starting something and then seeing it through to the end and finishing it, even if there are imperfections or what have you, versus doing one thing and doing it really well every time and being so good at it because you do it that way every time.
Yeah.
But never really doing anything in a sense. I don't know.
No, that was a really good way to word it, because that like flows perfectly into my next point, is that, yeah, so you had all these people working in essentially assembly lines, and anyone who's ever made anything knows there's a difference between having one simple role in a bigger thing. Like, it's different when your role is to, like, put the leg on a chair than if you handcrafted an entire chair yourself. If you envisioned it and you drew it out and you did all the work and then you made a chair and then you're like, hey, this is my chair. Mm-hmm. That's a very different experience than just putting the exact same leg on the exact same chair over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Those are very different experiences, which led a lot of people, including our main thinkers and kind of the people that I am focusing on for the purposes of this episode, John Ruskin and William Morris, were very concerned with this idea. Like, they were very, very kind of upset that people were being stripped of the experience of creating something start to finish. So they had thoughts. They were having some thoughts. And thusly written down and as a response to the Industrial Revolution. And it is also important to realize that a lot of people were stoked on the Industrial Revolution. Like, I'm going to get into this counter-argument, but a lot of people were really excited about mechanized production. There was the Great Exhibition of 1851, which is another thing we should do an entire episode about.
Writing it down.
So the Great Exhibition was basically, it was in Great Britain, and it was this really important exhibition that also in some ways tried to express Britain as like the winner of civilization, essentially, because it was like, hey, look at all these machines we have. It's so fucking cool. And people came from everywhere, like thousands and thousands. Was it in the millions? It was thousands and thousands,
yeah,
at least.
I don't know numbers. I'm bad with numbers.
People came from everywhere to see this exhibition and just like be like, wow, look at that fucking machine.
Yeah.
Like, people were really excited about it. So like, there was lots of people jazzed that we had machines that were making stuff and they thought it was really cool and everything. But then your boys, John Ruskin and William Morris, had kind of another idea, which I think I'm going to get into after we take a quick break.
Sounds good.
Hey dog, do you like BarkBox?
Well, you heard him, folks. And luckily for you, BarkBox is offering an opportunity to receive one free extra month of BarkBox at BarkBox.com.
For humans, BarkBox is a delivery of 4 to 6 natural treats and super fun toys curated around a surprise theme each month. For dogs, BarkBox is like the joy of a million belly scratches.
To receive 1 month free, go to GetBarkBox.com/babes. Again, that's getbarkbox.com/BABES. All right, and we're back talking about craft production. John Ruskin, William Morris, that's where I left off. Okay, so John Ruskin. This guy, disclaimer, was quite an imperialist and a bit of a racist, so not my favorite guy at all. But this idea of like craft-based morality in response to the Industrial Revolution did start with him, so I can't say it didn't. So.
And people are complex, so the nice thing about history is you can find a person and find the good things that they say and like them and find the shitty things that they say and ignore them.
Exactly! Or at least point out how problematic they
are. Yeah, exactly.
And then,
talk
like,
about how shitty it is first and then
Be like, but there's
put
this,
it to the side.
There's this thing too. So John Ruskin, he basically established this quote-unquote moral aesthetic. He never really used that term, but there have been writers on John Ruskin that have used that term to describe what he's talking about, and I think it's the best way to describe it as a moral aesthetic. There is a certain beauty that things have when they are handcrafted. There is an aesthetic that is created from that, and it is of moral goodness, is the idea. And so he established this moral aesthetic that was associated with handmade craft production as a response to industrialization. In 1853, the Nature of Gothic was published as part of Stones of Venice, which is like this three-volume treatise on Gothic architecture. It's insane. Like, I applaud anyone who's ever read the whole thing. I can't, like, imagine reading the whole thing. But I read Nature of Gothic, which is a chapter out of it, and it's good. It poses a lot of interesting things. I suppose if you're really into Gothic architecture, you should definitely read it. But, like, it's a lot. It's a very, very specific, very intense approach to Gothic architecture. And in The Nature of Gothic, Ruskin suggests that real beauty exists in the imperfection because imperfection illustrates the hand of man. So as opposed to a factory producing something perfectly over and over again, the hand of an individual is going to create imperfections no matter what, and that's part of the beauty of art, was his argument. And as a result, the handcrafted object is infused with a morality that is superior to the mass-produced object. So you're basically doing good by creating something with your own hands. And he also brought up a very important aspect of all this, especially when talking about marginalized groups and like the political element of this idea, is that basically, he made the argument that the Industrial Revolution, or just industrialized society, was dehumanizing workers by turning them into, like, a tool, like a cog in the machine, as we were talking about. So they're a cog in the machine, and therefore, you're taking away the joy of craftsmanship from your workers. They're not getting to create something entirely of their own making and stand back and be proud of what they just created. Interestingly, John Ruskin also came from a very Christian, very like Protestant background. So you have these interesting intersections between like labor and like Protestant work ethic and the idea that work makes God happy. So like, so say what you will about the Protestant work ethic, I do think Ruskin was kind of coming at it from a good place because he was also adding in this element of like, creating something makes God happy. You know, making something with your own hands that's beautiful makes God happy.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool, whether you're religious or not. I think that's kind of a cool idea.
It is. Because it's like the preaching of creativity.
Yeah.
More so than just being like, work so that you don't do bad things. It's like, work to make something beautiful that you can be proud of that is, quote unquote, moral and good.
What is that? Idle hands are the devil's
plaything.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a pretty typical Protestant work ethic ideal. But I agree. I think Ruskin, while interacting with that, was coming from it more of like a creative place. Mm-hmm. Which, like I said, whether you're religious or not, I think there is place for spirituality of some sort in creativity. So like, kind of a cool idea. Ruskin's ideas would go on to influence the ethos of the Arts and Crafts movement, which is another thing we're going to do a whole episode on because the Arts and Crafts movement is just like crazy important and a lot of important stuff happened there. But he was like a big deal for the creators of the Arts and Crafts movement. And there's a quote by him that was kind of one of their like mantras, and it goes, "It is only by labor that thought can be made healthy, and only by thought that labor can be made happy, and the two cannot be separated with impunity," which is kind of an intense quote. I'm gonna give you a minute to like sit on that one. There's a lot of stuff going on there, but I think it's interesting because I think he hits both the like, it's holy to engage in labor, but he also like, I think in a way points out some important things about like mental health and like making sure like you're doing things like creative things because it's just good for you, you know?
Well, and especially our day and age, it's like, I'm sure a lot of you listeners will be interested in things that relate on like keeping your mind, like, active in a healthy way and not just, like, you know, sitting on your phone or other electronics and zoning out and, like, really being engaged with things and, like, being creative and having some sort of output rather than just being, like, I don't know how to describe it.
A consumer?
Yeah, exactly. Instead of just being, like, consuming information and usually useless information or questionable, just depending on.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, tangent. Back to Corey.
But yeah, no, I think that is, once again, it's a quote worth ruminating on because it does, I think, apply to our current consumer culture in a lot of ways. But that was like a huge motto for the arts and crafts movement. A lot of people in the arts and crafts movement, you know, were kind of about this idea, which brings me to William Morris, who was very important to my thesis work. I love him a lot. and we'll also do an episode on him.
Yeah.
And he was not without his faults either, which I will discuss a little bit. But he, I think, took the ideas of Ruskin. He, like, picked up on these ideas of, like, self-conscious craft production. But he did move away from the religious aspect. He wasn't a religious person. He was very focused on social equality and happiness associated with craft production. So he kind of took Ruskin's ideas and just ran with them. And he was one of the, you know, forefront members of the arts and crafts movement. So basically he was very focused on this idea that beauty was essential to living a quality life. And to him, a lot of what he saw in industrialized society was not particularly beautiful. Like it was, you know, it was a mix of mechanized aesthetics, and then also you have issues with pollution, like that started back in the 1800s, like that was, you know, part of the whole thing. Just communities, he felt like Britain just didn't look as beautiful as it could, and so he was really into this idea of trying to just make our lives as beautiful as possible, which I think is really cute and awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really argue with the idea of, this marriage of morality and beauty.
Mm-hmm.
They do kind of go hand in hand
thought,
and I don't know.
And it's an important question. I mean, if you've ever taken any type of, like, aesthetics course or, like, have studied aesthetics philosophically, like, it's kind of, you know, at the core of that.
It is. And it can be problematic, so we're not completely condoning that all beautiful things are moral and anything that is not, quote-unquote, beautiful is amoral. We're not saying that at all, but it's, you know, it's an enticing thing.
Yeah, and I think it has good aspects. Like, while I definitely don't agree with everything Ruskin said, and I don't agree with everything Moore said, and like I said, we're going to talk a little bit more about the problematic aspects briefly. Like, the underlying ideas, I think, are very positive in a lot of ways. One of my favorite Morris quotes is, "What business do we have with art unless all can share it?" So he was, like, he was hella socialist. He was, like, a big socialist, but, like, he came at it from this very, well, one, he was a utopian socialist, so he had very utopian ideals, which I don't think are necessarily bad to have, like, idealistic aims, but he also, his socialism, like, he was a very important socialist writer in, like, the 1800s. Mm-hmm. He wrote so much about socialism, and it's, if you are interested in the history of socialism, you definitely need to read William Morris. But his approach to socialism, it stemmed from, like, aesthetic concerns and, like, concern with art, which was very different. And a lot of other socialists at the time, including, like, Karl Marx, were, like, not so hot on that, you know? So he definitely had his own approach to those ideas. Mm-hmm. And I do think, at least from everything I've read, he really did just want everyone to live a chill, beautiful life, which is, like, so nice.
Yeah. There's a reason that William Morris is still so talked about and, like, is such a prominent character.
He's been written about
character.
So much.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
The thing was, he was a hardcore worker. He, like, worked his ass off. In fact, when he died, the doctor said that when they like asked him like why he died, like the diagnosis basically was like just being William Morris and having like lived as much as 10 men or something like that. So he like worked really hard, but he also just like wanted a lot of the time, just wanted to be left alone in his studio to create things. Like he just wanted everyone to make stuff and like everyone to just like live equally, which I think is really beautiful. So after saying all those good things about William Morris, it is important to note that there was a fair amount of, in this ideology, there was a fair amount of medievalism and orientalism in the arts and crafts movement, which basically, we touched on this, I think, a little bit in Jen's thesis episode when we were talking about the romanticization of a simpler time.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that going on. It's thinking that, oh, industrialized civilizations ruining everything. Things were so much better in medieval times.
Yeah.
Things are so much better in simpler cultures, which at the time, like, India wasn't industrialized yet,
yeah.
You know? So, like, there's this romanticization
mm-hmm.
That can get real problematic really fast.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So that's something to be thinking about, and a topic we'll also probably discuss at length later. So, obviously, as much as I do like some of these ideas, they're not... That's the problem with any utopia. Like, you to have a utopian outlook, you have to ignore a lot of things,
yeah.
Unfortunately. So, since then, basically, this political aspect of craft production, and often somewhat socialist aspect of craft production, not always, but there is a connection with the ideology of socialism that happens throughout the next century in different craft movements. For example, like I mentioned before, so you have like knitting and embroidery, which are framed as women's work and not necessarily considered fine art, despite the fact that there's a lot of skill and labor and time that goes into these things. And if you look at, you can find embroideries that look like fucking paintings, like
mm-hmm.
Renaissance paintings, and for some reason, like, it's a lesser form of art. So you have this natural marginalization of craft production, which inherently makes it political. All of a sudden, you have these political issues as a part of it. And a lot of contemporary artists have touched on this. We have a lot of contemporary artists that work in craft mediums for this very reason. They're, like, using mediums that were intentionally, that had been marginalized to make a statement about marginalized
yeah.
populations. A really important source, this will be listed on our website, but Rosika Parker's The Subversive Stitch. Everyone needs to read this book. Like, I don't really, like, whether you're into craft or not, it's just a really important book, and it's really good. It came out in the 80s, and it's pretty much about the marginalization of embroidery throughout all of time, and it's just really good, so read it. So you have, like, that aspect of things, so that inherently makes craft production political. You also have, moving forward quite a few years into, like, the 60s and 70s, there was the emergence of the DIY aesthetic, which is still very much alive today. It was strong in the 80s, it was strong in the 90s, like, it's still a thing.
We got Etsy.
We love our Etsy. So the DIY or do-it-yourself aesthetic, which is another thing that deserves a whole episode, but basically it's, we have attached, especially in contemporary society where everything is at our fingertips all the time and everything's mass produced, we have become very attached to the do-it-yourself ethos. The idea that I can make this thing myself. I can make my own sweater. I can make my own table. I can, like, and that is attached to, like, the popularity of, like, artisanal living now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This, like, I want to pickle my own pickles. Like, right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like stuff like that. It comes from this place of wanting to maybe, one, attach to, like, a simpler time, quote-unquote simpler
mm-hmm.
time. But it also has an aesthetic meaning to it. Like, if you see someone that is wearing a sweater that they knit themselves, a lot of times it has a very intentionally hand-knit look about it. It's
mm-hmm.
meant to look like it's not been produced by a machine. It's meant to give off this presence of like, I fucking made this, or someone else made this with their hands. Yeah. Somebody made this with their hands is the idea. And that has created an association socially in our heads of being like, oh, that's fucking cool because somebody made that, you know? So it's like, there's this really, so that morality continues today into the DIY ethos and the fact that so many of us are so attached to it. It's like there's something really cool about seeing something that somebody made with their hands. Mm-hmm. And people get excited about it and people want to show it off and people like to talk about it. And it is because we associate a certain creativity, but also a certain moral standpoint with making something yourself. Yeah. And also, like, obviously there are a ton of political issues with contemporary capitalism and mass production. Like, we have sweatshops and we have, you know, people who aren't paid for making your fucking Forever 21 clothes, you know? Yes. Like, so, like, there is a political stance a lot of times that, not always, but a lot of times people are making a political stance by making their own clothing, you know? And so this idea, while I think sometimes seems very contemporary, has been around since mass production began, is really the main, I think, takeaway in this idea of the moral aesthetic. And like I mentioned before, this is also a very important idea that contemporary craft activism is working with. And I'm not going to get too into all the elements of craftivism, but it is part of this idea that you can make a political statement by handcrafting something. So yeah, that was at least the baseline theory of my thesis.
Yeah.
I hope it wasn't like too, I don't know, philosophical or heavy.
No,
but
I think it was, I mean, I think it was perfect. And I bet all our listeners do too. Yeah. But also, it's a super interesting thesis, so here's to that being published someday, and you guys can all read it, which would be awesome.
Let's make that happen.
Because it is super relevant and super interesting, you guys, so.
Thanks. That's so nice of you.
No problem. So shall we listener mail it for a
sec? Yeah, we'll do a quick listener mail.
All right.
Thank you all for listening to some of my thoughts and research and stuff.
Listen to Corey getting all bashful, guys. This is probably the first time that's ever happened on the podcast.
I don't know. I've just like kind of given my life to this for a while, so it's just kind of fun to talk about. But thank you for listening. Listener mail, what do we got?
All right. So we have a message from AJ. And the subject is, this show is the best, which is so sweet. All right, he says, hello, Art History Babes. My name is AJ, and I'm a senior from Utah State University that recently went to Paris through our business school program. On the plane ride over, it was about 12 hours, I wanted to listen to a not boring art history podcast, and I stumbled upon your amazing podcast series. One day, after we went to the Musée d'Orsay, I sat down with a glass, or a small bottle, of French Chardonnay. Cheers. And listen to your Impressionist podcast episode. It was interesting because you all spoke on Olympia, which is one of my most favorite Impressionist pieces. I could actually open a picture I took a couple of hours earlier of the original painting to examine it as you were speaking. It was absolutely breathtaking, and you were discussing an art piece that I had recently looked at. I can't wait until you all go to Paris and immerse yourself in such an overwhelming amount of art history in the busy city, which was lovely.
It was lovely. And Musée d'Orsay was like our favorite.
It really was so good. I'm wondering if you could pick one piece of art or a genre to be your favorite, what would it be and why?
That's such a hard question.
It really is.
So we just kind of picked this listener mail, so this is totally coming off like top of our heads, like what one of our favorites would be. I'm looking at a Gustav Klimt right now. He's definitely up there. I don't know if I pick him as my absolute favorite, but
I know,
he's definitely
it's hard
up there.
Because he's not necessarily extremely likable, but his art's so good.
Fuck, dude.
It's so good.
The first time I discovered him, I was like, what?
Oh. Yeah.
Once again, we love it all, so this idea of, like, picking a favorite is not...
This is literally just out of the moment, whatever comes to our heads right now. It's not necessarily what we would go to the grave saying our favorite thing is.
Yeah. But one of my favorite paintings, and this is one that's been with me for a very long time, one of my absolute favorite paintings, it's funny because I'm more of a contemporary person, like I focus a lot of my stuff on contemporary art, and I tend to attach to contemporary art, but one of my all-time favorite paintings is Lucretia by Rembrandt. Mm. And I definitely, so that painting.
That's a good one.
Yeah, and it's at the, was it Art Institute in Minneapolis? It's either Institute of Art or Art Institute in Minneapolis, which is a fantastic museum, and it's also free. So if you're in Minneapolis, you have to go. It's so good. But it was, like, I had learned about it in undergrad, and it just is, it's just a very intense image, but, like, still so beautiful. Like, because it's Lucretia, you know, like, killing herself. Like, it's, like, a very intense moment, but it's, like, calm for some reason and very just, like, beautiful. And you can, like, see, like, the sadness and, like, the life, like, flushing out of her face. And it's just, like, this really beautiful painting, which is the story of Lucretia. Is that a myth or is it a myth or is it an actual story?
No, I think it's true, right? Isn't it Lucrezia Borghese?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, no, it's super true. And she's a very tragic character. We could do an episode on that just because I feel like there is a lot of art and, like, literature that follow Lucrezia and everything that happened to her. So that would be a great
episode,
too.
Yeah, we should do a Lucrezia episode because, yeah, there's a lot of art about her. But the painting is just, it's very intense but beautiful and, like, oddly calming at the same time. And I didn't realize it was at this museum that I had, you know, visited before. And I was actually there with some friends while I was an undergrad. And I had been, like, wandering around the museum all day, like, listening to music. And I stumbled on it. And if you're an art lover, like, stumbling on a painting that you didn't realize, like, was in a museum that you're in is really, like, one of my favorite feelings in the entire world. And I just, like, I was listening to music. It was, like, some, I don't know, very, like, electro, down-tempo, like, techno-type stuff. And, like, I stumbled on it, and I just, like, was in awe. And it was a very cool experience for me, and one that I will probably never forget. So for that reason, and just because it's a beautiful painting, I would say that's definitely in the top of favorite artworks for me. If you're going favorite art movement, also a very hard thing to do, but I do love my abstract expressionists quite a bit. Anyone who's like, I'm going to throw some paint at a canvas to express my emotions, I'm like, fuck yeah. Like, I'm all about that. So yeah, that would be my answer. What about you, Natalie?
Yeah, I'm going to piggyback off of that because I was going to, I'm actually piggybacking in two ways because I was going to say definitely abstract expressionists if I was going to go movements, just because if I have to just sit and, like, push everything out of my mind and think of what I would just like to sit and look at, it really is, like, it's a Rothko.
Yeah.
It's something that's so simple. Yeah, if I had to go movement, that would be my route. Even artists that I kind of gravitate towards who wouldn't fall under the category of abstract expressionists, a lot of times some of their favorite works of mine are things that kind of dip into that realm.
That play with it.
Yeah, so I would definitely go that route, which is funny because that was never my interest. I've always been really into figural stuff, like, but that was as a painter when I was doing it more. And my second piggybacking experience was, if I had to say my favorite work, I had an experience at the, now I'm blanking on the name of the museum because it's in German, but it's in, or it's in Munich, and it's their contemporary art museum. It's, gosh, I'm really gonna blow this. Yeah, I'll look it up and I'll post a source or something. I'll let you guys know. I'll get back to you. But it's an Anselm Kiefer painting, and it's called Nero Paints, and it's so good. Oh, here it is, because I have it in my sources. It's called the Staatsgalerie Moderne Kunst in Munich. And silly me, when you're doing research, your brain is like, it's all at once completely on and also completely off. Like, you shut off to such normal things that would occur to you. So I talked about this painting in my undergrad thesis and cited it as being at this museum. Went to Munich, planned to go to this museum, didn't realize that this painting was there. So I came upon it. And it's just an unbelievable painting of, it's a field. And if you're familiar with Kiefer, his stuff's always, like, semi-abstracted. It's just never, like, fully... It's just, it's very paint heavy and, like,
dense and...
Dense is a good word for it. It's just heavy. Like, yeah. The amount of paint he's using and the amount of just material, it's like, a lot of times it feels like the canvas is just gonna, like, fall off the wall.
Exactly. And it's a huge painting, which I also didn't really realize, which is very dumb because the, you know, you write down the dimensions always. That goes in the sources. You know, whatever. Just, you realize all of your human flaws. But anyway, so this painting is huge, and I walked up to it and was, like, blown away to see it in person. And it's a field with an artist, what's it called? A palette? Yeah. Is that the right word? Yeah. How does that feel wrong? A palette. And there are paintbrushes coming out of the top of it, and they are, like, lit on fire. They almost look like little candles. And then you look into the background, and the fields are, like, burning. And it's this whole allusion to artwork being used for destructive purposes, which was very relevant. Anselm Kiefer is an Austrian or a German artist, and he was born, I think, during World War II. So he grew up in the aftermath. You learn about World War II, and you realize that a lot of art was, like, associated with Nazism that shouldn't have been. So, like, Wagner was, like, a big one that mm-hmm. Wagner's music was used as, like, Nazi anthems, which was not necessarily his intention, like, writing them, but they were kind of twisted and used in this.
Well, because a lot of times it was just, like, Hitler deciding what he liked and what he didn't. And so, yeah. Like, things Hitler liked became part of the Nazi,
exactly,
like, and it was like, that's nobody's fault. So, if, like, Hitler liked your work, like, that's not your exactly. fault. You know,
you did. Maybe you just made cool music.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
You were a good artist. Yeah, exactly. So he's kind of playing with that idea of artwork being used retrospectively to represent something that it was not intended to represent.
That's super interesting.
And it's a great painting, and I love it. And I saw it, and it was cool. And Corey reminded me of that feeling, so.
I've definitely had some feelings like that with Kiefer, too. I love Anselm Kiefer. One other just quick favorite. I have a huge thing for James Turrell.
Mm-hmm.
I love James Turrell. I love him so friggin' much. And, like, just his skyscapes and, like, the fact that, like, all of his work deals with perception and, like, fucking with your perception and, like, the way you see, like, it. He essentially takes... He takes light. He takes just, like, things that are in our natural world, in our everyday environment, and he's like, I'm gonna create this, like, experience for you where all of your perceptions are just, like, totally messed with, but in, like, the most calming, beautiful way. Like, there's nothing quite as transcendent. I mean, like, Rothko's up there, but there's nothing quite as transcendent as a Turrell for me a lot of the time, so... Turrell, James Turrell, definitely also in favorites.
Cool. And I'm just going to finish up CJ's message here because that was mid-letter. He says, I'm not sure if you're already planning on it, but I would love to hear a podcast on the evolution of women's body in art because it was interesting seeing all the different depictions of women's bodies all around Paris throughout the museums, garden, and other art. Thank you so much for your fun podcast. Keep it up. Very sweet, AJ. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's a great idea. We will add it to our ever-growing list of podcast ideas.
It's never gonna end! No, that was such a nice message and very thoughtful.
It was very sweet.
And that was just a fun question.
It was.
We like getting fun questions. So if you have any fun questions, email them to us at arthistorybabes@gmail.com. You can follow us on all of the social medias. We're on every social media out there.
Yeah, we really are.
So hit it up. If you dig us and you want to help out four post-grads who are in a lot of debt, you can head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes and donate. You can, I mean, just...
Write us a review on iTunes. Oh, we love that. They make us happy. They encourage people to listen to us. So, you know, if you don't like us, you know, don't write one. But if you do like us, I guess actually if you don't, no, send us a personal message. Yeah. Don't write it on there.
Yeah, if you guys have criticism, send them to us. Like, we'll take those into account.
Long-winded, you could write us a review. That's another really nice thing.
That is, yeah, it's really nice and that really helps us out. So if you have a minute, please head over to iTunes, Apple Podcasts and write us a review. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Y'all are great. We got one more thesis episode coming at you. So... make sure to check it out, and we'll catch you next time.
from Cabernet to Monet. They're here to slay the art history babes.
Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, like your household names.
Your Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, your Ninja, yeah, exactly.